So, what we did is we looked at homology groups for, you know, the vector space. For some reason, they're called homology group or cohomology groups, and not cohomology vector spaces. For groups, and we found that the first cohomology group describes complements in a semidirect product. The second cohomology group describes classes of extensions up to equivalence of extensions, which is a bit weaker than equivalence of groups by isomorphism. What we've seen in this example, that if you just go by the definition, this very quickly gets a rather large problem. I mean, our factor group had order 6, and we ended up, and the normal subgroup had order 4, and we ended up with vectors of dimension 50. Okay. So, clearly this is growing quite large. So, what one can do to make this more feasible is basically be more clever in the definition of coset representatives. So you know that if the coset representative for the product AB is the representative for A times the representative for B, then that cofactor is by definition trivial. That's how we killed the ones for the identity. And you can try to make this work as far as possible. So, to reduce calculations, of H to G N. Basically, the idea is have G A B. Sorry, I called this tau, right? I want that A B tau is A tau times B tau as often as possible. Okay, if that happens all the time, then we know we have a complement and the cofactors vanish. We can't hope it happens all the time, but at least we can hope that it happens a lot of times. And then we know that the corresponding cofactors must be trivial and we don't even need to deal with them. Okay, how can we achieve this? What we can do is we define some kind of normal form. No, sorry, let me start with one before. I want to pick generators for G. So, pick generators for G. Let's say these are G1 up to GM. Hey, good morning. Since we will need this, actually what I want is not just these generators, I want a presentation of these generators. So, G is... Okay, and I'll just write equal. Yes, you can again start separating things if you want to separate elements from letters representing these elements. I'll be a bit sloppy just to avoid introducing tons of bijections. So let's say it is generated by G1 up to GM subject to relators R1 up to RK. So these are relators. Okay, and now I pick a normal form for every element of G. every G in G as word in the generator's GI. Okay, so I just pick in some way that I say here is this element I will write in this form, and I consider that the normal form. Okay. Sometimes one can do this nice generically, as we did in the examples with the dihedral groups. Oh, they are of the form A to the something times B to the something. But it doesn't really matter. It just needs to be, for every element, we have some normal form. And in principle, you could just write them down. For every element, you write down a word and you say, that is what I consider the normal form. Okay. And now, what we can do is, if we have some word, if W is a word in the GI, one can bring this word into normal form. Okay, so I have some word in these generators. I want to have possibly a different word in the generators, which gives me the same group element. And how can I do this? I can do so by applying the relators and their conjugates. That's what the definition of the relators was, right? Okay, what do I mean by applying? Basically, by multiplying with. So, the relator is the identity in the group. I multiply with an element which in the group G is the identity. But if, for example, I would have that, this is probably easiest seen in an example. Let's say I have that A, B is B, A inverse. That means the relator, I can write as, let's multiply with these from the left, B inverse, A inverse, B, A inverse. Right? Okay. So then, if I take AB and I multiply with a relator, what do I get? And now I just do this multiplication in the free group. That is, of course, BA inverse. So applying any relator basically just means, since I allow conjugates, multiply with the relator. Here it is at the end. If the relator would be applied somewhere in the middle of the word, I just need to conjugate with the tail of the word. Right? The conjugation will kill the tail, then I apply that relator, which does the change, and then I multiply the tail on again. So, I can do this. I can bring any word into normal form by multiplying with relators. Okay. So, these normal forms shall be, is my definition of tau. So, define G tau is GI1 tau up to GIL tau if G is GI1 up to GIL is the normal form. Okay. And that doesn't have every word, just has one normal form, so there is no conflict or no contradiction in that. Okay, I've also seen I can bring every word into normal form by applying a conjugate, by multiplying with the conjugate of a relator. Well, what would happen with the on the other hand, what are the relators in the extension? In the relators are the identity in the factor group G. In the extension, E, the relator, R becomes R of these, well, represent in some way of the representatives is some element of the normal subgroup. Okay. And these relators I store. So what I do is I store R, each relator is something, let's call it, is something Ni in N. And these are the only cofactor. I mean, there are not any more cofactors. They're a bit more complicated than cofactors because they're products of multiple elements. So these are store instead of cofactors. Okay, and now if I have some product of the of representatives gi tau, I bring that product into normal form by multiplying with the conjugate of a relator. So I need to multiply with the relators, but actually now every relator is not trivial, but gives me something in N. So I multiply with conjugates of these elements. And that's all I need to do to describe the multiplication. So I only need to store cofactors, one cofactor for every relator. And that makes the space in which the cohomology group lives much smaller. So we had initially, in the example, we had S6 and we had 25 possible cofactors to store. If we say instead we take this group S3, generated by A and B, subject to the relations A squared, B cubed, and A B is BA inverse, we only have to store 3. And that makes it feasible to do so, because in general the number of relations is much smaller. And then, yes, then the process of calculating it is somewhat more complicated, because you always have this normal form business in there. And for certain classes of groups, in particular for solvable groups, one can define such normal forms in a nice way, basically associated to a composition series. And that's what makes it feasible to do these cohomology calculations. And that's indeed what has been used to construct lists of groups. If you take some order and you say, I want to have a list of all the groups, yes, you go through what are the possible orders of normal subgroups. You assume by induction that you know all groups of smaller order. You'd go through all possible factor groups, all possible normal subgroups. Okay, if they're not solvable, then things are a little bit more, one needs to do a bit more, but if they're solvable, well, then you can assume that the normal subgroup, you can split it into elementary abelian layers and do the just one of the layers, or you assume without loss of generality your normal subgroups are minimal normal, because then you will still construct everything. And you calculate cohomology, and you calculate the extensions. And you just need then to deal with the situation that you have isomorphisms which don't come from the equivalence of extensions. For example, if a group has several minimal normal subgroups, you can construct it in several ways. Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's something which is very hard to do by hand for examples which are bigger than somewhere 10 or so. But on the computer, this can easily be done. Well, if basically in the thousands, the only situation where things become complicated is if you have large prime powers. And the reason why it becomes complicated, because then at some point the cohomology groups become very, very large. They can get in dimensions of easily dimension 40, 50. And so you have a huge vector space there, and you need to look at then equivalence of these extensions, and you need to look at orbits on this big vector space. And that's the obstacle. But otherwise, yeah, this is now basically on the way to a recipe for constructing all these groups. Okay. Yeah. And on the other hand, if you want to describe, you can just, if you don't want to construct the groups, you can use it in a way to say, oh, if I have an extension, I can in some way describe it in terms of normal subgroup and vector group. And I think that actually some of the things Rachel has been doing, that she looks at Galois groups and wants to use, she has already some Galois group and she wants to make it larger. The obvious thing is to build an extension. And there she needs exactly these kinds of things. Okay. Yeah. The last thing I want to do in this, this is basically the situation, is to look at, in some way, an application, and that is the theorem of Schur and Sassenhaus. So this is probably, this is paragraph 3 or 4, I don't remember how I numbered it. Well, 4 is certainly safe. The theorem of Schur and Sassenhaus. And that theorem, in the end, is a purely group theoretic criterion which just looks at orders of normal subgroups and vector groups and gives a structural theorem. What does this theorem say? If let G be a group and I want it to be finite, I have a normal subgroup and I have that the GCD of the order of the normal subgroup and the order of the vector group is 1, then there exists a complement. Okay, and that is purely a group theoretic statement. It's one which is rather easy to state, and it uses, again, divisibility criteria. That's the kind of theorems group theory likes. Certain arithmetic criteria about the group and the subgroup give us information which is structural information about the group. The easiest example is if you take a cyclic group, and you take a normal subgroup. If the normal subgroup is of order co-prime to the order of the vector group, that means you have the full prime power, you have all primes occurring in the order of the normal subgroup to its full power, then there is a complement. Yes, because you can write M is P to the A1 times P2 to the A2 and so forth, and the cyclic group is a direct product of the cyclic group modulo P to the A1 cyclic group for P2 to the A2 and so forth. That's the basic case which one might consider as motivating this, but this holds in general. Okay. And this theorem basically was proven actually not by the two people together, but was proven with about 20 years difference. First, Schur proved it for the case that N is elementary abelian. And then Sassenhaus later proved it generally. And actually, Sassenhaus' proof needs to assume that either N is solvable or... Oh, why do I write G modulo N, of course. That N is solvable or G modulo N is solvable. And then there came the theorem of Veit and Thomson, which again came about 30 years later, which said the group of odd order is solvable. And if you have this condition, at least one of the two must have odd order. So that in the end gives the full proof of the theorem. Okay. Yeah. So that's what I want to show. And in some way one can also look at it as a statement, and that's in some way what Schur's statement is. It's a statement about cohomology in the situation that we have a module which is co-prime to the order of the group, whose order is co-prime to the order of the group acting on the module. And that's the situation of ordinary representation theory of things behave nicer. Okay, so let me start. This lemma is due to Issai Schur, and this is probably somewhere from around 1910 or so. I should have looked it up. Okay, assume N is a GFP vector space, G is a finite group, such that a finite group acting on N. Acting on N such that the GCD of the order of G and the order of N is 1. So group is of order co-prime to the order or to the characteristic of the vector space. Don't really need the order, I could just say it's co-prime to P. Then the claim is then the second cohomology group is trivial. Okay. So, let's prove this. What we need to show is that every co-cycle is a co-boundary. Right? This is co-cycles modulo co-boundaries. If the factor is trivial, everything in the numerator already must be in the denominator. So, show every co-cycle is a co-boundary. Okay, so let M A B be an element in the two co-cycles. Right? A possible factor system. This as a function from G cross G to N. Okay. And what I'm now doing is I do an averaging process. And that is something which occurs in other situations in representation theory. So if you're going to take the 666 next semester, you'll see something which is called Maschke's theorem, which is also for the case that the order of a module and the order of a group are co-prime. And in that case, similarly, some averaging process is done and shows that things behave nicely. So what I'm going to do is I set big M B shall be the product over all A in the group G M A comma B, and I consider this as a function from G to N. Okay. So M is a function with values in N, which is abelian. So the order of that product does not matter because they are with values in a commutative group. I take all the cofactors for every possible first argument, and I basically take their product.
Oh, so the AB is just like for the M.
M has two arguments. Yes. Awesome. M dot comma dot. Yeah.
Perfect. Awesome.
Yeah. And that's why, as a function from G cross G to G. Okay. So, and I know, because this is a cofactor. So I know a property of this n. What is the property of this? The property I know is that m a comma b c times m b comma c is m a b comma c times m a comma b conjugate by c. Okay. So, what I'm now going to do is I'm taking this equation here and I take a product on both sides over all possible A in F. Because I want to get to this somehow. My notes I had initially, last time I did it, I called this group F or factor group. And then I realized, no, it's easier to call it G because it's the group which is acting. Yeah, so we have A and G. Okay. Okay, and now what I actually do, okay, this is a little bit more complicated how I form the product. So let me write down what I'm forming. I'm forming MA comma BC times the product over A in G MB comma C. And on the other side, I'm forming the product over A in G of MAB. Comma C. This is around these. Times the product over A and G, M A comma B acted on by C. Okay, and whether they acted on by C, I could put there or out because it's a linear action. Okay, and because that identity holds, I claim this is the same. So I'm taking. Why is this the same? Because you temporarily call the A, the second product over A prime, pull both products to the front, and then see individually the factors are the same for A equals A prime. And,
we need that N is abelian, that's where we get from the...
And that we need again that is, if it is not abelian, it will not work. And that's really why Schur's theorem only works for the abelian case. You cannot rescue that proof for the non-abelian case. Because, then that will not work. Okay, so what do we get there? Well, what is this? This is by definition M, big M, BC. Right? This is, because this does not depend on A, is little m b comma c to the power order of g. What is this? Okay, here I have the product m a b. I have m a b comma c, and I'm running over all a. But if B is fixed, what this will do is, this will just permute the elements of the group, right? Mm-hmm. If I run through all elements A of the group and I multiply each of them with B, AB runs through all elements of the group. So this permutes the elements. Okay, so I could instead say I run over all AB in G, and then this is just what I defined as MC, big MC. And this is big MB conjugate by C. Okay. Right. So what I can do is I can solve for MB, C. MB, C. Well, initially I have MB, C to the order of G is equal to big MBC inverse times MC times MB acted on by C. Okay, there is one property I haven't yet used.
GCD?
Yes. And otherwise it's wrong, so I somewhere need to use the... Yeah, I mean, you take the cyclic group of order 4. That property is needed. So, and that property I will use to just get rid of this G. Okay. So, because the GCD is 1 of the order of G and the order of N is 1, there exists some number E or if you want to call it L, call it L. You don't need to worry how badly I'm writing the letters, such that the order of the group times this E is congruent to 1 modulo the order of N, or modulo P. Okay. So, what I do is now I just take the eth exponent on both sides. Okay, so I take the eth exponent here, and because these are, this big M are functions begin with value in N, I can pull the eth exponents in here separately. Okay, right, and then what is this? This together with the eth exponent is, okay, these are things with value in n. If I have something with value in n and I take the gth exponent and the eth exponent, because of this, that's the same as the first power. That's right? So that is equal to m b, c. Okay? Right. So what have I done? I have written my cofactors, but what MBC is. So, it means M dot comma dot is the image of the function. Okay, what is my function? It's the M to the E. MB to the E. And this, I consider this as a function out of the 1 cochains for GN. Okay, 1 cochains just means functions from G to N. Right? That is a function from G to N for every element B. This is the function which maps B to MB to the E. That is a function from G to N. Okay, if I take this function and I take the derivative operator D1, which goes from C1 to C2.
Two cochains. Then the image is MBC, because that is exactly what this derivative operator does. Or if you don't want to have it that abstract, just look back at the situation when we described basically what the two co-boundaries were. They were the images of functions under that map. So what we have seen is M is a two co-boundary. And we're done. So two co-boundary and we're done. The two cohomology group is trivial. Okay. I think one can even generalize this in a to other cohomology groups. So there is also, you get a similar result that if they're co-prime, actually there is just one class of complements. The first cohomology group is also trivial. I think this actually generalizes to arbitrary cohomology groups, but...
Is that just Hilbert 90 or something like it?
Yes, it's just Hilbert 90, I think, has the factor group also abelian or so. But it's basically the same statement as Hilbert 90. Yes, it's just that's a group theoretic statement. Okay, what is Hilbert 90? Number theory at the end of the 1900s had evolved quite a bit, and there were a lot of new results which in the end led to what is now called class field theory. And a lot of mathematicians felt, oh, there is something happening and we don't understand what is done. And David Hilbert, who was already a quite prominent mathematician at that time, was basically commissioned to write a survey article over the new developments in number theory. And in this survey article, he had theorems, and one of them, they were numbered, and one of them has number 90, and that theorem turns out to be very useful in number theory, and that goes under the name Hilbert 90. And is essentially such a... Yeah, I mean, there is very much a connection between group cohomology and class field theory. If you know what class field theory is, which I don't completely. Okay. Yes, but then indeed that is the... And I think there are even some formulations of Hilbert 90 which just say this cohomology group is trivial. Yeah. Okay. Right. So, let's prove the rest. I think the Veit-Thomson is just needed to show that all complements are conjugate. I think the existence of a complement doesn't mean that one of the groups is solvable. So this was sure a lemma of sure, and you can say this is now, as a corollary, you get the theorem if n is elementary abelian, then there is a complement. And Sassenhaus then proved about 20, 25 years later if n is a normal subgroup of G, the GCD of G and N is 1, then there exists a complement. And there is no assumption on N. The only assumption is the group. There are finite groups, otherwise this doesn't make sense. Okay, and the proof is by induction on the order of N.
okay, the base case is the base case that n has order 1. In that situation, this statement is trivial because g is the complement. Okay, so let's do the inductive step. And we do a case distinction. Let's, depending on whether n is minimal normal or not. Case 1, n is not minimal normal. So that means there exists a normal subgroup M, which is strictly smaller than n, which is normal in G. Okay, and what I'm going to do is that in this case the argument basically is purely an induction argument. Okay, why is this the case? So, I have the group G here, I have the normal subgroup N there, and I have another normal subgroup M there. Okay, and I have the trivial group. Okay, I go in the factor group G modulo M. In G modulo M, that is a group which is strictly smaller order. In G modulo M, I have a normal subgroup N modulo M. And I still have the orders are coprime. So there exists a complement. Let's call it U modulo M for some subgroup U here. Right? Because this group is smaller, and if this and this is coprime, this and this is coprime. Right? Because the order of this is just a divisor of the order of this. So in the factor group, I must have a complement. This complement, if I take the full pre-image of this complement under the natural homomorphism, I get some subgroup here. That's the pre-image, that's just the homomorphism theorem. Or one of the consequences of the isomorphism, the nth isomorphism theorem for the appropriate n. Okay. Is that clear how I... That's just induction on the smaller group. So I have a complement there. And now I do induction once more. This group U is strictly smaller than G. Because this, I assume that this is not the same. Right? That M is not equal to N. So this, or this index is the same as this index. This is bigger than 1, so this index is bigger than 1. So U is strictly smaller than G. So I once more use induction. On M, which is a normal subgroup in U. What can I tell about the GCD of the order of U modulo M with the order of M? Well, the order of U modulo M is the same as the order of G modulo N, right? Isomorphism theorem. What is the order of M? The order of M divides the order of N because it's a subgroup. So this is 1. So I can use induction, so I know there exists a subgroup V. And now it's not hard to see that V is a complement to N. And indeed also how you can calculate complements on the computer. That's how it reduces. If the normal subgroup is not minimally normal, it goes and does it in steps via the factor group. Right, and why why is this argument drawing these withdrawing these pictures? Why is this a valid argument? Well, if you had an element which of okay, V and N will generate G. Okay, that is V and M together will generate U. So V and N together will certainly generate U, and U and N together will generate G. That was because I had problems. So V and N clearly will generate G together. Why do they intersect trivially? Well, if you had an element which lay would lie in V and in N, you would have an element, because it lies in V, it also lies in U. You would have an element which lies in U and in N, and therefore would lie in M. So this element which would lie in V and N would actually also lie in M. So it would lie in V and M, and they intersected trivially. So this element has to be trivial. That's written out, well, not written, spelled out, the argument for arguing with these kinds of diagrams. I find them, I mean, I learned this from my advisor, I find them very useful. This is basically just using the isomorphism theorem. And it avoids having to write down the natural maps and doing things with the natural maps all the time. But basically what you need is that one of the subgroups of that something is normal. If both are subgroups, then you don't have the isomorphism theorem anymore. If they're not normal, and then you can't do this kind of argument. Well, you can make this kind of argument, but it's not necessarily true. Okay, and that's the first case. The second case is that N is minimally normal. Case 2. N is minimally normal. Okay. So, what do I want to do here? Okay, I could try to say, let's distinguish whether N is abelian, and then if N is abelian, I go to Schur's theorem, or if N is not abelian, and then I need to do something else. But it turns out basically this something else works in all the situations. So that's why I'm not doing that case distinction, which in some way would be obvious. I can save the case which would be obvious will follow from the non-obvious case. So what I'm going to do is let P be a prime which divides the order of G and does not divide the order of N. Okay, and that is little p, and I take big P is a P pseudo subgroup of G. Okay, so then I know that this pseudo subgroup clearly will intersect trivially with N. Okay, what I claim is then G can be written as a not a semi-direct product, but just as a product of the normalizer in G of P times N. So this just means the set of all products. Okay. And this argument that this holds actually occurs often enough in group theory that it has a name. It is called the Frattini argument. Named after an Italian mathematician, Frattini, whose name I'm probably mispronouncing severely, who came up with this. Okay, So,
I assume that's just because that's one of the definitions of routine subgroup too, as well. Isn't it when you break it up into a normal subgroup and another fella? Oh wait, no, then it has to be like
No. We had a homework problem about the Frattini subgroup, and in some way it's related. There is something related, but it's not in where he used that kind of argument. Okay, so why is this the case? I need to show any element in G can be written as such a product. So let little g be an element in G. And I consider why do I say it does not divide the order of n. I wanted to divide the order of n, because otherwise I can't somehow, I want to go to this pseudo subgroup, and I want to go to a normal subgroup of a pseudo subgroup, namely the intersection with n. So I want actually that it divides. I don't know why I wrote here does not divide. I want that it divides the order of n.
So it divides both? Would that be?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that then the GCD not be?
Sorry, GCD of and here, of course, I should have said G modulo n.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm taking a pseudo subgroup, which is in there. Okay. So. Well, all pseudo subgroups for a given prime are conjugate in the group. If P divides the order of n, therefore it does not divide the order of G modulo n. Right? Because of this co-prime condition. So a P pseudo subgroup of G must lie in n. Right? There is, if you take a P pseudo subgroup of N, it also must be a P pseudo subgroup of G because of the divisibility condition. So take a P pseudo subgroup of N, that also is a P pseudo subgroup of G. If you take any other P pseudo subgroup of G, that must be conjugate to this one which lies in N. Or the one which lies in N, I can conjugate to the other one. But if I conjugate, I can't leave N because it is normal. Right? So it is also a P pseudo subgroup of N. Okay, and what I'm now doing is I look at P conjugate by G. Well, that is another P pseudo subgroup of G. So it is also another P pseudo subgroup of N. Well, N is a group. All P pseudo subgroups of N are conjugate. So it means there exists an element little n in N such that P to the G is equal to P to the little n. Okay? So this means that G N inverse maps P to P. So it lies in the normalizer in G of P. Right? If two elements map in the same way, their quotient lies in the stabilizer. And the stabilizer of a subgroup is called the normalizer. So G N inverse lies in the normalizer. Well, but then G lies in the normalizer times N. Okay. So I can write G in this way. Okay, and now the question is basically, what can I tell about this normalizer? And now let's draw again a nice picture. So I have the group G here, I have the normal subgroup N there. In N I have somewhere the subgroup P, the P pseudo subgroup. Okay. And now I'm looking at the normalizer in G of P. That together with N will generate G. That's just the argument which I've made here. Right? And this normalizer will intersect somewhere with N, and this intersection just is the normalizer in N of P. Okay. So, now, last case of speech. What could happen is this group, these two groups could be the same. There is nothing excluding this. P could be normal in G. For example, if G is a relay. So, let's first look at the case that this normalizer is not equal to G. Case one, let's assume that the normalizer in G of P is strictly smaller than G. Then what happens? Well, then I claim the normalizer in N of P is strictly smaller than N. Why is this the case? That's the case because this is normal in this subgroup. That's again the isomorphism here. Right? This is a normal subgroup, this is a subgroup. Then this index is the same as this index, and they are actually isomorphic. G modulo N is isomorphic to this, and this index is the same as this index. Right? If this index is bigger than 1, therefore this index is bigger than 1. That's just the standard statement of the isomorphism theorem for a normal subgroup and a subgroup. And that subgroup just happens to be normalizer of some other thing. But if you call this U, N and U, and U two, then it's immediately the statement. So that's the isomorphism theorem, that normalizer in N of P is also strictly smaller than N. So all these lines which I've drawn really have a length. Okay. Then let's look at the GCD of the order of the normalizer in N of P and the order of the normalizer in G of P modulo the normalizer in N of P. So I'm looking at this order here, and I'm looking at this order here, right? And I'm looking at their GCD. Okay, what is this order here? That is by isomorphism theorem, the same as the order of G modulo N, right? What is the order of the normalizer in N? Well, that must divide the order of N because it's a subgroup of N. So that has order, that GCD must have order 1 by my global assumption of this and this being co-prime. Okay. Right. This is strictly smaller than G, so I can apply induction. By induction, there exists a subgroup U which lies in the normalizer in G of P, which complements the normalizer in N of P. So I will get a subgroup U here which complements this normalizer. Okay. And Now I basically do it. I have, if I ignore this P here, which anyhow wasn't normal, which I just needed initially to get to that subgroup, now I have exactly the same situation as in this picture. Right? I have a normal subgroup. I have, well, almost the same, because this is only normal there. I have a normal subgroup. I have a subgroup here. This is normal in that subgroup. I have a complement here. Well, U and this together generate this. This and this together generate this. So U and N together generate G. What would happen if with an element which would lie in U and N? That element would lie in here and in here. So it would lie in there. So that element would lie in there and in there, but it's a complement, so it must be the identity. Okay, then U is a complement to N in G. Okay, right. So I'm almost done.
Sorry, I have just a quick question. You said that the order of N. The normalizer of P and N is equal to the order of N?
No, divides the order of N.
Oh, okay.
It's a subgroup.
Okay, cool. That's why I was confused.
No. I don't assume that P is normal at N.
Great.
No. Actually, if P is normal in N, then that could happen. That could happen.
Yeah.
Okay. So case 2 is the normalizer in G of P is equal to G. Right. So that could happen. Well, there are some things I have not used, namely the minimal normal for N. I also did the proof of Schur's theorem first. And indeed, I need this. So far, it looks, I can just prove it directly, but one can't. One really needs Schur's theorem here at this point. And that's why the whole thing is called the theorem of Schur and Sassnaus, and not just from Sassnaus. So, if the normalizer in G of P is equal to G, well, that means that P is normal in G. But we had assumed that N is minimally normal. As N is minimally normal, it means that N is equal to P. N is a P group. Well, but we know how minimal normal subgroups, which are P groups, look like. They are elementary abelian. So N is isomorphic to CP to some exponent. It's abelian. Elementary abelian. Okay, and now I use Schur's theorem. Schur's theorem says there exists a complement. And then done. Okay. Yeah, so we have, if the order of a normal subgroup and the order of the factor group are co-prime, there is a complement, and one can actually show with a little bit more work that there is exactly one conjugacy class of complements. So not just is H2 trivial, also H1 is trivial, and it generalizes to the case that N is not abelian. And that is, as I mentioned before, a structural result which just uses divisibility properties of group orders, which is the kind of result group theory likes. Okay. Yeah, that is basically what I wanted to do this semester. I hope it wasn't too confusing or with too much interruption in between. Unless you have questions, basically. Thank you very much for being attentive. And yeah, next semester I'll be teaching a class on the 666. Will be a class on representation theory, mainly ordinary representation theory. They're really building up all the theory, and then looking at some aspects of modular representation theory to get to the point that one can understand the statements and what the objects are. I probably won't be proving everything there, because there is a little bit at the start which is trivial for number theorists, but for other people it's hard work, which is essentially showing something about how that you can have subrings of an algebraic extension where the quotient is where you get with ideals where the quotient would be an extension of a prime field in characteristic P. So that if you have the integers modulo P, that you can extend this to algebraic extensions, and that this will behave nicely with ideals. And yeah, I mean, as the number theorist will say, yeah, of course it holds. And just proving that takes a couple of weeks with all the ideals. Anyhow, so that's what I'm planning to do next semester. If you're interested, I would be very happy to have you there. Yeah, thank you very much. Good luck with the final exams, either in writing or grading. Yeah. Mm-hmm.